You're listening to Season 10 of Mobile Suit Breakdown, a weekly podcast covering the entirety of sci-fi mega-franchise Mobile Suit Gundam from 1979 to today.
This is episode 10.10, In the Ruins of This Beautiful Place, and we are your hosts. I'm Tom, commanding officer of the Shrek team. You know, like ogres.
And I'm Nina, new to Victory Gundam and enjoying the Shrike team's Charlie's Angels vibe. Mobile Suit Breakdown is made possible by 745 paying subscribers. Thank you all, and special thanks to our newest patrons, Chris W., Born Slippy, aren't we all? And Lando the Lost. You keep MSB Genki.
This week on MSB, Victory Episode 10, Senretsu Shurakutai, or Vivid Shrike Team. The episode was written by Tomita Sukehiro, storyboarded by Nishimori Akira, and directed by Tamada Hiroshi, with Nishimura Nobuyoshi overseeing the animation. Remarkably, the credits for this episode list only two key animators by name, Nishimura himself and fellow Studio Dove animator Enokimoto Katsunori. The rest of the key animation was handled by Studio Dove's South Korean satellite office, Seoul Dove, and none of those animators were credited by name. If you'd like to learn more about Studio Dove and its work on Victory, Nishimura himself was recently the subject of a long and very revealing interview by Mateo Watsky, which talks quite a bit about his experiences working on Victory, how studios like Dove fit into the overall Sunrise anime ecosystem, and the development of their various satellite offices, including Seoul Dove. I'll drop a link in the show notes. And now, the recap.
While the crew of the Kamion are busy with repairs and maintenance for the Victory Gundam, Marbet gives Oliver the cold shoulder. Her irritation is obvious, but she refuses to explain what's bothering her, and Oliver is forced to let things lie, for now. A coded message arrives from Jin Jahannam, the leader of the League Militaire, with new instructions to gather at DD within 28 hours. Work done, the youngsters sit in the cab of one of the trucks. Odello and Warren play poker, Shakti plays with Karaman, and Uso surreptitiously looks through the photos of Katajina he has on his laptop and frets. Are Katajina and Chronicle really going to Ardy Gibraltar? What for? What will happen if Zanskar has intercepted and decoded the recent League Militaire orders? It's fairly obvious that DD means Dresden. When he voices these worries to Odello, the older boy points out that there's another way to interpret those orders, and that the Kamion is currently driving away from Dresden. But under Uso's continued prodding, Odello gets annoyed and snaps at him to drop it. Instead, Uso climbs up to the top of the truck to think things through alone. He sketches maps and possible troop movements in the dirt coating the Kamion, only to be interrupted by Haro. Perhaps trying to make a point, Haro blows a bubble and projects a video onto it, a video of Uso as a young child, injured trying to cut down a tree. Uso's father admonishes him for acting recklessly, and while cleaning and bandaging the injury, his mother gently chides him, telling him that now that he's a big boy, he needs to be more observant. Uso pops the bubble, and whatever Haro was trying to say, all Uso hears is that his parents were always lecturing him. It seems that Shakti and Haro have similar instincts, because still wearing Karaman on her back, Shakti clambers up next to Uso and declares that if he goes, she wants to come with him. They sneak aboard the Victory and take off, the old men of the Kamion trying to convince them not to go, even as they fly out of view. Uso was right about one thing. Zanskar have intercepted and decoded Jin Jahannam's recent message. Dupre, determined to distinguish himself after his recent promotion, leads a squad from Largain to intercept the League Militaire forces. Their flight path takes them over woods awash in lilac blooms, a mist of pink petals hanging in the breeze. But Shakti's delight is short-lived. They spot the Bespa squad approaching, and in moments are surrounded by the enemy force. Uso is hesitant to fight with Shakti in the core fighter, even as she insists he shouldn't worry about her. Dupre, thrilled to have caught the Gundam that's been causing such mayhem, finds the excitement of combat turned to dismay. Their maneuvering gives him a close-up view of the core fighter's cockpit, and he sees that the enemy pilot is a child, just a few years younger than his own son. He orders his pilots not to shoot down the League military plane, but to capture it and its pilot. Surrounded, Uso can't see a way out until reinforcements arrive. It's Oliver, with the six-member strike team, and Uso is so relieved he barely notices Oliver scolding him. Having been told to expect amateurs, the Bespa pilots are unpleasantly surprised by the strike team's skill and ferocity, and Uso takes this opportunity to drop Shakti and Carlman off in the woods, tossing Shakti a flare gun before taking off to retrieve a hangar part from Oliver and form the Victory Gundam. The transformation sequence leaves him vulnerable, and by the time it's done, one of the enemy mobile suits is bearing down on him. With a yell, Uso fires, and for the first time, hits an enemy mobile suit engine. The explosion levels the trees around him. With little cover in the woods, Shakti curls on the ground, waiting for the blinding, roaring explosion to end. When it does, she checks on Carlman, then takes off at a run, collapsing when she reaches the camion. They have been unable to monitor the fight, too far away to identify individual mobile suits by sight, and the Minovsky particle density too high for radio communications. At first, their focus is on medical attention for Shakti, but between gasping breaths, she tells them not to worry about her, to go help Uso. Uso and the Shrike team send the Bespa force running, having shot down three of the original seven mobile suits, including Dupre's. Despite freezing up after the explosion, Uso fights well, and the Shrike team pilots are impressed. The camion arrives, and the pilots all land to meet properly and debrief. It's then that Uso learns the Shrike team is comprised entirely of women, with the exception of their commander, Oliver. Oliver greets each of the Shrike team pilots with a compliment on their appearance or a comment about their love life. Watching from a distance, Marbet mutters angrily that Oliver acts like such a ladies' man. Then Oliver turns to Uso. With a face that reminds Uso of his own father when angry, Oliver tells Uso that, as a proper soldier now, he cannot go herring off on his own. Then, after giving Uso very precise instructions on how to stand, puts a coda on this dressing down by punching Uso in the face, hard enough that the boy goes flying. So naturally, while watching this episode, I had to look up lilacs, which are depicted fairly faithfully here. There is one shot where the flowers are drawn very clearly, and if you compare that to pictures of lilacs, that is what they look like. However, they generally bloom in early summer, and we know that fireweed, which we also saw blooming, is usually blooming in late summer, which can only mean that humanity so messed up the Earth that by the universal century, the seasons are just completely messed up.
You are overlooking some other possibilities here. I acknowledge that that is perhaps the most likely, but have you considered that roughly 8 months has passed between the prior episode and this one?
Or perhaps that the writers, designers, etc. for this show really do a vibes-based environmental storytelling? What do they care about the bloom seasons? If they want to depict lilacs, then by God, they are going to depict lilacs.
You know, I find your theory that the contents of the show have been determined by some all-powerful group of writers and artists and creators to be patently absurd. These things spring into existence out of nothing, just like
buildings.
Just like buildings springing up out of the ground or flowers blooming from plants. It can't be explained. No one is responsible for it. It just happens.
One should never let physical realities interfere with good storytelling.
I mean, I agree with that. The other possibility, of course, is that humanity, in its overweening egoism and its desire to shape its environment to suit its own transient and short-sighted needs, has genetically modified one or both of these plants to bloom at more convenient times, without any regard for the possible fallout for the environment caused thereby.
I do love the shot after Uso hits one of the enemies and the reactor explodes. Shakti, after the explosion has passed, sits up and flower petals are stuck to her face.
Yeah, the back half of this episode, like everything from when they first enter the lilac groves, looks really good. It's some of the best looking episodes of Victory that we've seen so far. Some of that is the quality of the backgrounds, these painted, beautiful flower fields. Some of that is the quality of the motion. A lot of that is just the amount of stuff going on screen, like the lilac petals flowing across in the wind. It's quite beautiful. And I think this would have required more effort, more work. I think it was more difficult to make it look this good. And I wonder if this episode might have been treated a little bit differently by the animation staff, particularly in the back half of it, because during the production of Victory, Sunrise changed what type of film they were using to photograph the cells from 35mm to the much cheaper 16mm. They did that starting on the next episode. Mm. And the animators found out about the change during production of this episode.
Mm.
It makes sense to go from 35 to 16 when you're shooting on threes, when you're not shading anything, when it's a very budget-conscious show that is trying to not look that great. Or to be more accurate, they are consciously eschewing many of the labor-intensive techniques that tend to make things look better. There was some feeling at the time of like, why are we using this expensive premium film when we're making this?
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense to downgrade to the cheaper 16mm, but maybe they felt like this is the last hurrah. Like, this is our last episode on the good film. Let's make it count. Let's make it look good.
One big blowout before they go to the cheaper medium.
Exactly. Of course, there are also different teams working in rotation on these episodes, and maybe it just happened to be that this was one of the more skilled teams.
Two other visuals I really enjoyed were the heroic flying poses of the Shrike team at that one point.
It looks like something you'd see from the Justice League. Everybody, like, chests forward, flying in formation, heroically up into the air.
Arms back, the music changes to mm-hmm. also be very, like, stirring and martial. And then the thunderstorm with the lightning
Ooh,
at the end.
Yeah, so then ominous in the distance.
We're in the wreckage of these beautiful woods, and then off in the mountainous distance, lightning flashes and dark clouds loom.
Worse things to come. When we talk about storms on the horizon in art, like, this is what they represent, the ominous imposition of the future.
The visuals may have been impressive, but there is one aspect of the storytelling in this episode that I took issue with. It may seem like a small thing, but many of these episodes have a last time on in the introduction where the narrator, who did our initial explainer on the state of things in the UC, goes on to talk a little bit about what happened in the previous episode. But this narrator often tells us things about the previous episode that were not at all evident in the episode itself.
This narrator editorializes, yeah.
Well, if it's editorializing, from whose perspective? Like, whose perspective are we being given
mm-hmm.
by that? Or are they just trying to shoehorn in more information that they couldn't find a way to convey in the previous episode? Because frankly, I think that's bad storytelling.
Well, let's get specific. What are you thinking of?
The narrator tells us that the, quote, warmth of Casarelia made Katagina feel jealousy. At no point in that episode is it at all evident that Katagina feels any jealousy about this Casarelia situation. None.
Yeah, I noted that one down too. Though I picked it up because of the interesting visuals that they chose to accompany that line, which is that it plays over the footage of Shakti changing Carlman's diaper. And it's like, oh, we're getting very gendered here. We're getting like, even though we have established that Katagina hates babies, we're like talking about her jealousy towards Shakti as caregiver to this little baby. Okay.
Or perhaps, I mean, if we accept that she felt jealousy, which I don't, mm-hmm. sorry. If we accept that she felt jealousy, which I'm not sure that I do, it may be more, not a specific jealousy of Shakti in this role as caregiver, but a hunger for this idealized depiction of family life. What we know about Katagina's parents and upbringing It seems unlikely that she had many of these quiet, loving moments with a mother who doted on her and was with her constantly throughout her infancy. That was not really the vibe of Katagina's family. And so, again, if we accept that there was jealousy, I suspect it's more in that vein of like, oh, this is the kind of family life, this idealized image is what I feel like I missed out on or what I always wanted.
Or maybe she's idealizing the simplistic life out in the countryside. Two notes about that. I was thinking the other day about the different layers of reliability in terms of what we see in the show, that the least reliable is when a character says something to another character. Because there are so many reasons why they might lie to themselves, to the other person. They might just generally not be getting it. So character statements are very unreliable. Things that characters say to themselves or when alone, or that they like think when we get audible thinking, those are somewhat more reliable, but still leave open the possibility that the character is lying to themselves.
Or simply doesn't know what they're talking about.
The narrator is then the next like level of reliable above a character. Although if the narrator is themselves a character, then it's less reliable than if the narrator is like the word of God.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this particular narrator is meant to be an omniscient narrator.
Mm-hmm.
I just object to this method of imparting information within a story.
I agree with you. And I think what we see in the visuals is even more reliable than a narrator. If what the narrator says directly conflicts with what we've seen, then we have to assume that the narrator is wrong. But because of the way the production gets made, and here we're going back to your frankly ludicrous idea that people make these things and that the form that they take is influenced by the circumstances of their production, these episodes get made somewhat in parallel. So you might start working on episode 8 before you start working on episode 9, but you start on episode 9 before you finish episode 8. And Tomino has this philosophy that if something changes between the initial script and the storyboards, you never go back to the script and change the storyboards. The storyboards become the new script, and that you sort of always move forward like that. Which means that if you have something in the script of episode 8 that does not get conveyed in the storyboards, then it just disappears. But the script for episode 9 will be based not on the finished version of episode 8, but on the script version. So it's possible that the stuff referenced in the opening narration here was meant to be conveyed in the previous episode and just wasn't.
That was my leading suspicion, that that information was meant to be conveyed to us somehow and simply was not for whatever reason. They ran out of time, they couldn't fit it in, somebody messed up, whatever.
And the scriptwriter of episode 9 writing this opening narration is thinking, like, these are the really important things in episode 8. If the person who did the storyboards didn't think that those were the important bits, then they could easily get dropped.
Another consideration, I don't know to what degree this may or may not have happened on Victory, but we have certainly noticed in other Gundam shows that different lead writers often can have very different takes on the same character and can portray the same character very differently on their respective episodes. There may be writers on this team who see Katagina one way and other writers who see her another, and there is a certain amount of wrangling happening in terms of then how she's portrayed within the show itself.
I've often wondered if maybe things like the intro narration and the sort of next time on narrations at the end, if those might actually be written by a completely different person. They often feel different in style and sometimes in content in a way that makes me think maybe they're being done as a distinct part of the creative process by a different person. Katagina is not in this episode at all, and yet we've already talked so much about her, and we will continue to do so because while she may be absent, her presence is still being felt by a certain someone.
Before we get to that, I did want to touch on one other complaint, which we've both talked about a few times. This comes up over and over again, but we get the introduction of a new name and two completely different spellings for that name. One of them in the subtitles and one of them diegetic, shown on a computer screen within the episode. And that is Jin Jahanam or Janaham, depending on which spelling you go with.
And I think on the screen, it's Jing. I think there's a G at the end.
It's either J-I-N-N in the subtitles or J-H-I-N-G on the screen. And then for the last name, J-A-H-A-N-N-A-M, that's in the subtitles, or J-A-N-A-H-A-H-M.
I mean, my policy that if it's written on screen, it is correct, even if it's not the only correct answer, remains in place here. Here, though, the reason they changed it, I think, is fairly evident. Uso says, in this brief scene where they drop a bunch of names and a bunch of name explanations, which hit me like a flashbang, this whole thing was like, whoa, that is way too much information to take in and assimilate. But when he says that Jahannam is a term for hell, Jahannam is the term for the analog to hell that exists in Islam.
And he mentions that jinn, like the, you know, the powerful spirit or demon that lives in hell.
Right.
One of the powerful demons or spirits that live there.
Right. Jinn, like a genie. So when the real world connection, when the origin of the name is that well established in the actual text of the episode, it would be a little bit weird if the name that they were using just A, didn't match the way it's pronounced, and B, wasn't the thing that they're explicitly saying that it's referencing.
Which of those two things were they saying is Uso in Hindu? Jinn or
Jahannam? I don't know.
I mean, jinn in Hindi is also jinn, or like very close. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it quite right, but it's very similar to, I guess he pulled the original words from Arabic.
Seems like it. Although if it were just like a generalized demon of hell, I think like Rakshasa.
Yeah.
And I think the Hindu version of hell is called Naraka. So I haven't the foggiest idea what Uso is doing in all of this.
So if any of you speak Hindi and have any idea what Hindi word they are talking about, please let us know. I was also pretty flabbergasted by the statement that Ligue Militaire means Holy Alliance, or in Japanese, Shinsei Dome, and that it comes from ancient Roman. Excuse me?
Excuse me? I was not surprised by that because I knew it was coming and have been thinking about this for a while, but it is bizarre. Ligue Militaire does not mean Holy Alliance. Ligue Militaire means Military League or Military Alliance. The term in Japanese, Shinsei Dome, usually refers to the Holy Alliance, which was a post-Napoleonic alliance of conservative states of Europe intended to suppress any future liberal revolutions. Which I guess in theory this could maybe be a reference to, but I don't think that's accurate. And also, in English, there's like at least a dozen different organizations in European history that have been called the Holy Alliance, Holy League, Sacred Alliance, Sacred Union, some variation on that, many of which have used Latin words for their official title.
Holy Roman Empire.
So what they're actually referring to here is a big puzzle that I have been trying to fit together for a long time, and sometime before the end of this season, I will do a research piece on it. The real kicker is, I don't know whether or not it's meant to be connected to Zanskar's guillotine, to the idea of Zanskar as a foreign interloper, whether that's connected to the name of Zanskar being taken from a region of India, whether all of this is of a piece meant to fit together, or if they're all being pulled from completely disparate sources.
Okay, now that I have that off of my chest, we can continue talking about Katajina.
Thank you. I had been hoping, after seeing Uso's personal development in the last few episodes, that he might have started to get over his obsession with Katajina, but it's pretty clear that she remains his guiding star. When he is placed in mortal danger, the first thing he thinks is, oh no, if I get captured or killed, I won't be able to see Miss Katajina again. Kid.
He manages to kind of delude himself early on that, oh, I'm just investigating whether this is really a feint by the other guys, this, that, and the other. But he admits once he's in the cockpit, like, oh, I am not going to get to see Ms. Katajina here. She is not near RT Gibraltar after all. I feel very foolish that He convinced me. He really had me convinced early on that he was just thinking himself in circles, like overthinking this and worrying about it as a person who overthinks a lot of things and worries about them. I can understand that feeling where you've managed to get yourself worked up and worried about something to the point where you can't calm down until you go and check on it yourself. And with me, this is usually something mundane, like I'll become convinced that I might have left the sink running in the kitchen and flooded the kitchen. And so I will get out of bed at 2 a.m. to check and make absolutely sure that I did not flood the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But the same principle, right? But no, he's just obsessed with Katajina.
No, I mean, I think they're both there. He does really think himself into a tizzy about this. He does earnestly seem to think that, like, in this game of back and forth cat and mouse espionage of codes and double codes of diversionary movements and feints and double feints, that somehow the League Militaire is not thinking far enough ahead and that they're going to get caught out in one of these traps and that he actually is doing something for the good of the whole group. Yes,
I think
he has in fact found an angle.
I think he's just self-deluded, but...
Well, he is self-deluded. Rare L for Uso this week. He also, in his first appearance in the episode, I think, is looking at photos of Katajina on his laptop, very kind of surreptitiously guarding the screen to make sure that nobody else sees that he's looking at these photos of her. And these photos, it's only 3 of them this time, and they're on screen a little bit longer, so you can actually study them. And it's, like, now pretty evident that these are stalker photos. These are, like, paparazzi style, only now we know that she actually is just a private individual. That Uso has been, like, following around and taking photos of her when she's not looking, when she's just out with her friend, going shopping.
Uso seems harmless enough, but the problem with excusing unacceptable behavior when kids do it is those kids grow up to be adults and don't always grow out of those behaviors. I'm not saying he should go to jail or anything extreme, but I'm saying somebody in his life should point out to him that this is a creepy thing to do. This is creepy and invasive and bad, and he shouldn't do it, because what's to say that he won't continue to behave in this obsessive, creepy way once he's a grown man?
Uso developing into Mantra before our very eyes.
After last week's episode and seeing Katajina choose Chronicle and Uso's clear heartbreak over this, I really wondered, is this some kind of really common formative experience for boys and young men? You develop intense feelings for an older girl and then complete and utter heartbreak when she rejects you for someone more age-appropriate? Because I feel like I've seen this storyline play out in so many different pieces of fiction, and not just in anime, also in American shows, in movies, as almost like a rite of passage or like a common early childhood heartbreak kind of thing.
I mean, I never experienced anything like that, but you're right. It's very present in media about young boys. And I do remember there was a time when I was in middle school when a bunch of the guys in my class were all obsessed with this one high school girl. So, you know, empirical evidence, it does happen sometimes. I don't know if any of them got their hearts broken when she dated someone her own age. I don't know that any of them
actually thought they had a shot with her.
Yeah, or got close enough to have a conversation with her. But certainly there was a marked interest.
A lot of this episode, to me, felt as though it was developing this theme or idea of Uso as being between things. And that's very much a part of being the age that he is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're like not quite a child and you're not an adult. He reveals all of this deep, kind of eclectic, odd knowledge at the beginning of the episode. And we already know he's an incredibly talented and skilled mobile suit pilot.
We also know he's been learning this stuff off of the computer banks. So this is basically a kid who has not gone to school but had unlimited access to Wikipedia.
More or less, yeah.
That is the basis of his education.
But at the same time, there is so much he doesn't know, so much he needs to learn, so many skills he needs to develop. And while this kind of depends on who is doing the teaching, who is doing the lecturing, there is some degree of resentment that adults feel this need to lecture him. Haro does this cute little projection trick. Uso is sitting there like, oh, I have to think through this on my own. He wants to be by himself. Haro blows a big bubble and projects some videos from Uso's very early childhood. And it took until my second watch through for me to pinpoint why Haro would do this. And it reveals a stunning amount of intelligence, actually, on Haro's part.
I agree with that.
Really incredible. Because the memory, the video that Haro chooses shows the aftermath of little baby Uso apparently having tried to cut down a tree by himself and having gotten hurt in the process, and his father describing him as having done this recklessly, that he didn't really think through what he was doing, and so that's why he got hurt. And then he runs to his mother, and she cleans up the wound, and she's taking care of him, but at the same time, she's like, well, you're getting to be a bigger boy now. You need to be more considerate with your actions. You need to be more thoughtful. Haro is trying to hint to Uso not to act recklessly, not to be impulsive, to actually think through the likely implications of what he's doing. But what Uso takes away from this is, ugh, all my parents did was lecture me all the time.
The video Haro chooses is not just an example of a time that Uso acted recklessly and got hurt over it, but a time when he acted recklessly without consulting anybody else, when he thought he saw something that needed to be done and went and tried to do it by himself without adequately preparing and without figuring out if it was actually a good idea, which is exactly what he's doing here.
I mean, he knows that he's going to be told not to go, so he doesn't tell anybody.
See, I'm willing to give Uso the benefit of the doubt that he really does think that this is a problem, that it's not all just because he wants to fly off to RT Gibraltar and find Katajina, that he actually does think the camion is rolling into a trap of some kind. But he's not willing to discuss that with the other members of his cell. He's not willing to raise the possibility with them and, like, try to convince them that actually they've made a mistake. He just tries to take this independent, autonomous action.
But he does grow. He does learn. And again, very typical for young people his age, seems much more open to being lectured by people who aren't his parents.
Mm-hmm.
He's much more willing to accept that from other people, even as he resents it and wants, like, more independence vis-a-vis his parents. Because by the end of the episode, he has that brief conversation with one of the Shrike team members where he's like, oh, none of us can do this alone, can we?
Well, that's the message of the episode. It's the rare Gundam episode that really feels like a teen drama with a very special message. And it's that, yeah, you can't do it alone. You do actually need comrades that you can rely on in order to be able to do anything. But he's not receptive to the lecturing and scolding of the old man Polycule before he goes through all of these experiences. It's only after he's made the mistake, seen how it turned out, seen the risk that it put Shakti and Karlmann in, and realized the mistake he made, that he's contrite, and now he's willing to accept their guidance.
Another indicator of how he is changing, though this is really only emphasized visually. Now he is the one causing a lot of environmental damage, or rather, the side he's on. Whereas before, there was this sense of the League Militaire as almost being protected by their environment, and Vespa and Zonskar being hostile to the environment. Now it's like, oh no, all war, no matter who's doing it, is destructive and hostile to the environment.
There is so much to say about this. My mind is going in a million different directions, unfortunately. The first one, because we've already talked about it, remember in the Haro soap bubble memory projection, what Uso had been trying to do was cut down a tree and got hurt in the process because the tree struck back, in a way, is sort of how his dad expresses it. It was a reckless action to try to do it, and because he was small and weak, he failed. Now, he's bigger, he's stronger, but he's still reckless, and it is his reckless action of shooting the Tomliat and accidentally hitting the main reactor and setting it off that causes the big explosion that does most of the environmental damage that we see. Again, it's recklessness.
I don't agree.
Oh?
That scene where he blows the reactor on the Tomliat is shown slowed down, but that Tomliat was already so close to him. They were basically at point blank range. I understand that this is a cartoon, and so Uso can do whatever the animators want him to be able to do. But theoretically speaking, he does not have the time or the luxury to be choosy about where he shoots. He needs to save himself. I felt like the point of showing this destruction is much broader. It's not even about Uso specifically, because that explosion may take out a ton of the forest, but even before that explosion, his Gundam moving through the lilac woods is shown like snapping off branches. At the end, the camion is driving over this wreckage and we see the wood like breaking apart under its tires.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about Uso specifically.
But it is also about Uso specifically. It is more general. I agree with that. I think in this episode, we are seeing a pretty significant shift in how the League military is depicted. As this little cell that has been operating on its own, defending its own little patch of the Earth, has become more integrated into the larger structure, the larger organization, there is a feeling of it changing. The level of discipline and professionalism that Oliver expects and imposes on this group is very different from the way they operated before.
I love the juxtaposition at the end of the episode of a member of the strike team ruffling Uso's hair, which is very much a gesture towards a child, right? That is a gesture of affection towards a kid. And then Oliver laying down the law, so to speak, and saying, "You're a soldier now, you have to maintain military discipline. You can't keep herring off by yourself now that you're one of us, one of these legit soldiers." And the, at this point, ritualistic Gundam punch to the face.
Right. Our now annual tradition of talking about the corporal punishment of children continues this week. But before that, also the contrast between the rigid adherence to military discipline that Oliver shows with Uso versus his frankly flirtatious treatment of his subordinates, which is, "I don't think that's appropriate in the army, Oliver. I don't think that's allowed by the regulations."
There's allowed and allowed, right? Like, as sort of kind of came up when I was talking about women in Japan at this time, what a lot of people considered acceptable behavior towards women in the workplace was not the same as what the law necessarily considered acceptable. And people got away with a lot, because those were the social mores of the time.
Hey, that's connected to the corporal punishment of children. Because by this point, we have the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which calls upon its signatories to take all appropriate measures in order to prevent physical violence against children, including corporal punishment.
But Oliver's speech has just established he's punching a fellow soldier in the face, not a child, from his perspective.
It's ironic because what he's doing seriously undermines, like, the point of the episode. The point of the episode is that to be effective in combat or doing anything, really, you have to be able to rely on other people. You have to be able to trust your compatriots. But there's now a mountain of good research-based evidence that physically punishing children undermines rather than reinforces the family bond and the bond between the child and the caregiver who is doing the punishing. Punching Uso is not going to strengthen unit cohesion. It is not going to make Uso more willing to rely on Oliver and trust him.
And we know that, but we also know that the writers believed that this was good, I won't say parenting generally, but this is how fathers are supposed to be. And Uso even says, "Oh, he looks just like my dad looks when he's mad. This is angry dad moment."
Mm-hmm.
Ah, if I want to make sure you have learned your lesson, I have to include some aspect of physical pain here. That is how I show you how serious this is and how serious I am. It's wrong, but that is what they believed. That is what they were conveying.
I think Uso's willingness to take the punch demonstrates that it is unnecessary.
So you think he knew he was going to be punched in the face?
I think he did.
I was not so sure, although I did have the moment where I was like, wait, why does he need to grit his teeth? I guess some bonus points here that he didn't just sucker punch the kid, which we have seen happen before.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, I'm going to allow you to brace yourself.
You know, he looks when he's like flying. This is the last shot of the episode, is him like flying through the air, grimacing and crying a little after he's been punched. He looks just like Char did after Camille punched him on Earth in episode like 16 of Zeta, somewhere around there.
For me, the question going forward is, how are these various adults going to navigate Uso's in-betweenness? Uso learning to navigate it is simply part of growing up. Every kid goes through that. But by making him a soldier, they have complicated their lives considerably, because does that mean they treat him like an adult and give him adult levels of responsibility and freedoms? Or do they still treat him like a kid, and how can they do that when they've said, like, but you're a soldier? It really complicates things for them. So how they navigate that will be, I'm sure, infuriating.
Rather than a position of in-betweenness, I see Uso as an outsider in this episode. This is expressed in part through his unwillingness to talk to the other people in the group, for his eagerness for autonomy, and those pictures of Katajina, always taken from stealth, always taken from the outside looking in. That has been his experience as a person living in Casarelia, on the perimeter of Uig, living illegally there. He has always been the outsider, and he still remains so here. There is a sense of egoism to his behavior here, of this belief that he knows best, he's figured it all out, he's the smartest one and the one who can do it all. And that egoism gets broken down through the course of the episode as more and more bad things happen to him that he can't control. Egoism is also a watchword in the novels, and is sort of throughout Gundam, throughout Tomino's work, has been kind of like the primordial sin of humanity, the hallmark of everything bad about modern humans, and our desire for personal convenience and security and perpetuation of our status quo being placed above things like respect for nature.
He is an outsider. There's no question of that. And it absolutely affects his behavior in certain ways. But I don't know. I think there's much more emphasis on his youth and his being on the cusp of this transition to adulthood than there is on his status as an illegal resident. I also think that that egoism, that confidence that, oh, I've figured it out and no one else has and I can handle this on my own, is also very common in young people. is characteristic of a lot of young folks.
But by contrast, the Odello crew, Odello, Warren, and Susie, are all now pretty thoroughly integrated into the operations of the Camion. Like, maybe we'll get some more challenges to that later on, but they're early dancing in and out, wondering if maybe they should make a break for it, maybe they can get a better deal somewhere else, doesn't show up at all in this episode. And though their role in it is only quite brief, when Uso is doing his whole, like, Mission Impossible attempt to sneak his way into the core fighter cockpit with Shakti and Carlman without anyone seeing him, Warren, Susie, and Odello are all, like, just doing the regular maintenance of the Camion in sync with everybody else.
It's not necessarily emphasized in this episode, but I see Uso's continued disconnection from the group as being a product of how cagey and private he is about his feelings. That almost everyone else in this group expresses their feelings much more openly and frankly than he does. He hides everything, almost. And I couldn't say why off the top of my head, but my sense is that the show points to that as the reason why he can't form closer bonds with people, because he's not being his honest self with them. And you can't form close bonds with people if you can't be honest with them.
She might not be concealing it very well, but Marbet is not being particularly open and honest about her feelings this week. Her irritation with Oliver is evident, but she is doing her best to conceal it and to not talk about it.
I don't think she's making any effort to conceal her feelings. There's an important difference between hiding your feelings and not being willing to talk about your openly displayed feelings.
Hmm.
He knows she's upset with him, and she at no point attempts to hide or refute that. It's very obvious. Her total refusal to speak to him makes it pretty clear that she is upset. If she really wanted to hide her feelings, she would act like normal. She simply doesn't want to talk to him about it. Those are different things.
Or she is doing her best to act like normal, and she just can't. At the beginning, Oliver is like, I'm pretty sure you're mad. And she's like, I'm not mad. Why do you think I'm mad? Uso, give me the screw.
We don't know enough to pinpoint exactly what's happening here. We know there is at least a romantic facet to it because Uso calls it out as like a play lover's quarrel or a practice for a lover's quarrel. I suspect it's somewhat more complicated, that the jealousy is personal and professional. Deeply curious as to whether or not Oliver is the one who decided that the strike team would be all women, since we found out he is, in fact, their commanding officer.
I think he recruited all of them. He was, like, traveling around Europe looking for qualified pilots and just happened to find a bunch of really tall, young, beautiful women to do it.
He has, for each of these women, a comment on her appearance or her love life. Funnily enough, in a way, the fact that he just sort of runs through one of these comments for each of these women makes it less flirty. Like, no one is being singled out. It feels like this is just how he interacts with these women, not that he is bringing to bear, like, romantic or sexual attention on anyone specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is just the way he is.
If he had been more like that when he was on the Camion, it would feel less suspicious. But
well,
the fact that he is almost completely different with them than he is with everybody else.
The only other adult woman we see him interact with is Marbet. We don't see him interact with what's-her-face.
Ness.
Ness, thank you. And I think they're the only adult women on the Camion. So who else would he compliment? Would he have little compliments for all the Oji-san Tachi?
Yes. Yes, he should. I would feel much more positively about him if he did that. I don't know. If he had that attitude of like, it's not romantic, I'm just saying nice little things about everybody, I would expect him to have nice little things to say about Odello and Warren and Susie. Warren, you drive the truck so good. Susie, love your sheep handling.
And in the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a lake of whiskey. Like, while we may not approve of it, the fact that he treats women and men differently and adults and children differently is not unusual in our society. The layers of this that I'm curious about are, is Marbet interested in him romantically and he just doesn't realize it? Are they romantically involved and she's annoyed that he flirts with other women? Where in an odd way, he might think of the flirting as like, oh, that's a thing I do with women who I don't care about. Like, that's just like a casual greasing the wheels of society thing. I couldn't do that with you who I care about. I couldn't be flippant like that.
I think that probably is what is going on. That, like, Marbet is special, and that's why he doesn't flirt with her in the same way.
But from her perspective, this is a problem. It also occurred to me maybe she wanted to be on strike team and he didn't pick her.
She does fit the strike team model, doesn't she?
And the way she looks at the group, you know, she says to herself, ugh, acting like such a ladies' man. But there's also this sense of longing there.
Oh, do you think she's feeling like maybe an outsider? Like she's looking in from the outside?
Also maybe caught in between because we know she's not a very experienced pilot and these other women are clearly quite experienced and good at what they do.
Marbet has been out doing what is like probably the more important mission, working on the Victory Gundam, but it means she has been away from this group. If they've been training, if they've been in combat together, like these are professional soldiers. They know what they are doing. But if Marbet had joined the strike team, would she also be at that level? The desperate situation on the Camion has not exactly been a good environment to develop those skills, unless you're the chosen child.
So yeah, I firmly believe there is an element of professional jealousy here too. It's not purely this romantic entanglement or whatever. But since we are talking about the strike team, two things. First of all, they are repeatedly described as reckless. A word which you brought up in connection to Uso earlier. Only with them, it seems to be a positive.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting. I had not connected the Shrike team to that repeated use of the term reckless, but you're right. They definitely are.
And I guess this isn't really a separate thing, more of an observation, but there has, in certain times, in certain places, been this idea that women are, in fact, more dangerous fighters than men. And this is often couched in terms of this stereotype of women as more emotional, but that makes them fiercer, that makes them deadlier. That means you cannot expect them to, you know, retreat when it's rational to retreat.
There's also this idea that women are more likely to be underhanded, that they don't understand honor the way men do. And so a woman opponent can't be trusted. A woman opponent is unpredictable.
But there's less of that in this episode. The sense from the Bespa guys, from Dupre and his squad, seems to be more that they wouldn't expect this kind of commitment of forces, this level of intensity of fighting right off the bat on an enemy who's just making a feint. That it seems like too much for the situation, and that surprises them. It is also the Shrike team that makes one of these other pilots comment, "I thought we were supposed to be fighting amateurs," which really made me wonder about what kind of intel they had before they got here. Like, I flashed back a little bit to the early days of Russia's recent invasion of Ukraine. Well, recent, it's been a year or more now. But when there were some stories coming out that many of the Russian soldiers did not know that that was what they were doing, they were told something else. And then they got to Ukraine and realized what was really happening. Mm-hmm. And so what exactly has Zanskar been telling these people? Is it that they have been telling their own soldiers some kind of propagandized story about what's going on here? Is it that they have simply underestimated their opponent, another common military error? Or do they just have bad intel?
Well, the Ligue Militaire is clearly not a cohesive organization. It's a lot of different cells doing different things in different places. Some of its people are civilians with rifles. Some of its people are professional military mobile suit pilots. The origins of the people who join the Ligue Militaire are pretty broad. But if it's anything like AUG, which I think is probably its closest, AUG or Karaba, I guess, are probably its like closest analogs in past Gundam. In this episode, one of the old men says, we're doing this, we're putting up a fight because we hope that if we can put up a good enough fight, we will draw the Earth Federation into the conflict. But like, there are probably Earth Federation soldiers who think that the Federation should be involved now and have joined the Ligue Militaire sub rosa. That's kind of my theory for Oliver and the Shrike team ladies.
I can contextually figure out what sub rosa means, but I don't actually absolutely know what it means. So maybe you should explain that. So I assume you mean like when people join as volunteers in a foreign army.
Sub rosa literally means like under the rose, but roses as a signifier for clandestine operations, for secrecy and covert things. So secretly joining the Ligue Militaire, despite ostensibly being part of an uninvolved military. The way during World War II, for instance, a whole bunch of like U.S. Army pilots got permission to travel as civilians to hotspots like China and operate their own completely not the U.S. military air corps.
Gotcha. One area in which Zanskar's intel is apparently doing quite well is code cracking, because they have already figured out the karaoke code.
Could they have figured it out if Dupre was not apparently an obsessive fan of McKinley?
I assumed that was a joke, but
I didn't realize that the 25th president of the United States produced so many banger hits.
And was two hot anime ladies.
I actually knew that already. If you had studied American history to the level that I have, you would know that almost half of our presidents have actually been anime ladies. You see, in the Fate series...
Fate, ruining searches for historical figures since as long as it's existed. There is a very brief glimpse at some kind of internal to Zanskar politics or conflict, because we learn that Dupre really does not want Pippi Needham around. He wants to get rid of him, which kind of implies that Pipiniden is a representative of a rival faction, is someone who's been sent there to keep an eye on Dupre, and he resents this incursion.
Yeah, speaking of fate, Dupre appears to meet his at the end of this episode.
I think this position might be cursed. I mean, Farrah Griffin is on her way to trial. Dupre has been shot down, maybe dead.
It really looked like the only part of his copter that got shot was the cockpit. Like, I saw it, smoke was coming out of it, it was descending slowly, and I was like, oh, maybe he survived. And then it's like, no, I think he got shot directly in the him. He was the only part of that mobile suit destroyed.
Series wrap on Dupre.
Right after, he seemed to be setting himself up to be a recurring antagonist for this next arc. Right after he seemed to be inserting himself into this back-and-forth political fight within Zanskar.
And they give him a lot of character development in this episode that is different from what we've seen previously. He had that kind of greasy, smarmy Grand Vizier vibe when Farrah Griffin was around, and kind of maintained that in the past couple episodes. But then here we find out he used to be a pilot himself and was promoted out of the cockpit. He wants to distinguish himself on the battlefield. And like so many other Zanskar soldiers, once he realizes he's fighting a child, he freaks out. He thinks about his own son, who is 16 years old. He goes from, these lilacs will be your grave, to,
as the father of a young boy, I personally feel that we should not kill you.
And even though it's dangerous, tells his men, don't shoot down the plane, try to capture it without killing anybody. Like, he really does not want to kill a kid.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said of the benefit the League military gets from using this child in combat over and above his actual competencies as a soldier. Like, it's pretty dark that probably the reason Dupre's squadron fared so poorly in this episode is because they were trying not to kill the children. And the Shrike team didn't know that. They didn't know that Dupre was holding back, but they still took full advantage of it.
While I cannot think of any off the top of my head, I'm sure there are analogs in other conflicts and in other wars in which a particular task or posting or region is basically like the kiss of death to your career, that everybody who tries to take on this specific task fails spectacularly, dies, it's the end of their career, like something goes horribly wrong, like whatever the place is or the assignment, it just spells doom for everyone who tries it. It is the invading Russia in winter of postings.
I think a lot of what's going on in this series is inspired by the French Revolution because of the guillotine and for other reasons that I'll talk about more in the future. But during the wars of the French Revolution, there were actually a lot of postings that fit that description, especially in the period when France was doing very poorly in the War of the First Coalition. There were so many command postings where if a general made one mistake, they would be hauled back to Paris and executed. And a lot of them would like choose suicide or defection to avoid that problem. Or the position of commander of the French forces in Haiti during the Haitian Revolution was not a good place to be.
You don't say. Do you suppose that naming the leader of the League militaire Hell Demon to inspire fear into the enemy was a purposeful nod to everyone calling the Gundam the White Devil?
But remember my research. They hadn't started doing that yet.
Even now? Even in Victory, they weren't doing that?
No, they're still just calling him Shiroi Yatsu.
That white guy.
Or Gundam Modoki. At this point, I think the only white devil in Gundam fandom is the SD Cubile from that one Cardass trading card, and Anna Velgato in the Neue Zeal in the novel version of 0083.
Be that as it may, these are some people who clearly understand the power of a name.
It is really interesting as a name, and I'm wondering whether or not it fits into the League Militaire as Holy Alliance thing. Holy Alliance, Unholy Leader, something like that. But also, many of the historical, like, Sacred Leagues and Holy Alliances in European history were specifically alliances of European states against Ottoman incursion. There's a whole like dangerous Orient aspect to this. It's tied in with the history of Orientalism and the like the threat of the outsider to Europe, which Zanskar now represents. Like there is so much going on here. And I don't think it reduces down to any kind of a simple explanation like this means this and it represents this and it's meant to convey this single thing. It's pulling in all of these loose strands and weaving together this basket out of them.
Oh, I completely agree. But that's why when earlier you were wondering whether there was some kind of cohesiveness to the references in use here, I didn't say anything, but I really don't think so. I think time has shown us that when they pull references, there isn't usually any kind of like overarching attempt to make those references work together necessarily.
Maybe or maybe not. In First Gundam, the overall motif of the references seemed to be the Pacific War.
First Gundam was the most cohesive of all of them.
I just think sometimes you can identify a principal reference, a principal motif for the whole show. And then if you can do that and do it accurately, it can inform other references. So should I be looking for a Holy Alliance, a Shinsei Dome, that is connected to the French Revolution or not? I don't know. There was a resistance movement called the Catholic and Royal Armies, which could theoretically be the basis for a Holy Alliance resistance movement. And there was the Holy Alliance that followed the Napoleonic Wars.
That just doesn't explain the Jin Jahannam tie-in.
No, it doesn't. But we haven't met Jin Jahannam yet.
And now Tom's research on the name of the Shrike Team's transport craft.
Toward the end of this episode, Warren and Odello briefly discuss the newly arrived Shrike Team and their Gun Easy mobile suits. Warren observes that the machines that carried them into battle aren't armed, and Odello reminds him of the crucial importance of logistics in warfare. It's a nice scene for these two, who have fallen into logistics support roles aboard the Kamion, and a reinforcement of the episode's overall message, that no one, no matter how special, can fight a war alone. Uso needs people to reload the Vulcans on the core fighter just as much or more than he needs backup on the battlefield. The subtext of the episode is also about collective action, but intriguingly, it cuts against the main text by focusing more on the difficulties of working in groups for a common cause. On the Bespa side, we immediately see the friction of internal rivalry, the hostility of the Largain-based Yellow Jackets towards the interloper Pipiniden. Each soldier has their own goals that align only roughly with those of the army as a whole. Dupre's personal ambition to distinguish himself in battle mingles with this distrust and compels him to take the field personally, resulting in his apparent death and yet another disruption to the already fragile chain of command in Largain. The League Militaire is also struggling with the challenges of communication and coordination, demonstrated in the coded communique with its multiple layers of meaning, and by Uso's inability to trust the judgment of his fellow rebels. And they are also dealing with the arrival of an outsider who is disrupting the group's cohesion. I don't think it's a coincidence that Oliver enters the story only one episode after Pipiniden makes his first appearance, and Dupre's resentment towards Pipiniden and his squadron find a mirror in Marbet's jealousy toward the Shrike Team. Oliver imposes a sense of professionalism and discipline strikingly at odds with the attitude shown thus far by this little band of armed refugees. At the same time, orders from the mysterious Jin Jahannam threaten to entangle them in the League Militaire's larger mission. The old men of the Kamion seem to only know the general contours of that mission. For them, this has only ever been about trying to protect their little corner of the Earth Sphere. But that's just boring old subtext. Let's talk about the Mecha. During their chat, Warren drops the name of the new mobile suit-bearing hovercraft that brought the Shrikes to the battlefield. He calls them Setters, though you'd be forgiven for missing it because, at least in our subtitles, the word Setter hasn't been capitalized like the proper noun that it is. These Setters, or Seta in Japanese, are the latest of what Gundam calls subflight systems. The same English term is used in Japanese. These are support machines capable of transporting mobile suits further and faster than the mobile suits could manage on their own. The original subflight system was Zeon's Dodai back in First Gundam, although we did see a Lagun reconnaissance aircraft pressed into that role in the Kukuru's Doan's Island episode. Zeta had the Base Jabber, Dodai Kai, and Geta subflight systems, and Char's counterattack added the ominously named Shackles as a Neo-Zeon space-use rocket sled kind of thing. By that point, the term Geta, originally the name for a specific type of machine, was being used by both sides as shorthand for any kind of subflight system. These various names are somewhat linked one to another. Dodai means base, the base of something, in Japanese, and hence its successor, the Base Jabber. Geta are traditional wooden sandals, and shackles might also be worn around the ankles. Now, there's no obvious explanation for where the jabber part of Base Jabber comes from, but I can think of one possibility. The word geta is composed of two kanji. The ge sound is another way of pronouncing shita, the kanji for below. It doesn't get used in any of the words that mean base in the sense of a foundation on which other things might be placed, but it is used in geiretsu and kato, words that mean base like debased, vulgar, inferior, despicable. The ta sound in geta comes from a kanji that, when used as a suffix, means something that needs to be carried, like a load or a burden. On its own, it means a pack horse. And when used as a prefix, it means something trivial or worthless. When you combine it with ben, a kanji that means, among many other things, speech, you get daberu, to jabber. So, with a reasonable dollop of linguistic creativity, geta could be shorthand for debased jabbering, and thus, the Base Jabber. It's possible.
My one other thought about jabber is that we often talk about getting an injection as getting a jab, and so like insertion. Something that inserts the force into a location. But I like your explanation too.
Fortunately, the setters do not require nearly so much creativity to fit into this overall pattern. In all likelihood, they take their name from a different and somewhat less famous kind of traditional Japanese sandal, the seta. Seta are a type of zori, straw flip-flop-like sandals held on the foot with a fabric thong. Seta are distinguished from other types of zori by two principal features, a leather sole and a metal heel. Both features improve the shoe's performance when walking in snow. The leather sole protects the straw from moisture and, combined with the metal heel, improves traction on slippery terrain. When written in kanji, the name seta includes the character for snow. Besides the nigh-identical names, the setters also look a bit like seta, with the main body of the aircraft looking like the hanao strap on the sandal. You can almost imagine some giant foot sliding into a pair of setters. Seta are a relatively recent innovation for Japanese footwear. While geta go back at least 4,000 years and zori are about 1,000 years old, seta were introduced only a few centuries ago, probably during the Sengoku period, rising to popularity during the Edo period that followed, and then declining after the introduction of Western-style footwear. They are still worn today, in particular by sumo wrestlers of certain ranks, certain kinds of priests, and at least one famous soccer player. There are three principal legends about the invention of the first seta and how they got their name, each of which offers a slightly different version of the problem that they were invented to solve. One version of the story says that sumo wrestlers in the Edo period were accustomed to wearing zori, but their great weight caused the simple straw sandals to wear out too quickly. Some shogun, the only source I found for this version of the story didn't specify which one, decided to take up the problem, and he instructed his vassals to come up with a solution. They designed a new, more durable sandal, with leather soles and metal heels, woven from white bamboo sheath instead of green bamboo straw. It was thus given the snow sandal name for its color. Another version says that low-ranking magistrates in Edo, Doshin, whose duties included patrolling the streets and pursuing criminals, were constantly slipping and falling like in a Benny Hill routine whenever they had to run around in their plain straw sandals. The chief magistrate referred the problem to a local inventor, who came up with the leather and metal upgrade parts. This story seems somewhat dubious, but it is true enough that Doshin did wear seta during the Edo period, and the distinctive clang of the metal heel on stone as the magistrates walked or ran around the city is said to have served the same purpose as a modern police siren. Finally, the third and most frequently repeated story attributes them to a certain preeminent master of the tea ceremony, Sen no Rikyu, considered to be the most influential figure in the development of the Way of Tea. Born during the Sengoku period, Rikyu served as tea master to Oda Nobunaga and his successor, Hideyoshi Toyotomi, although his relationship with the latter warlord eventually soured, and Hideyoshi ordered Rikyu's death in 1591. As for his contributions to the world of footwear, the story goes that Rikyu was working in his garden one day when he slipped and fell, injuring himself. His patron, Nobunaga, was alarmed by this damage to his precious tea master, and so he presented Rikyu with a pair of Western-style shoes, more suitable for such mucky work. Rikyu refused to wear them. He felt that such shoes were incompatible with the principles of the tea ceremony. Seeing this, Nobunaga gave orders that the leather sole and riveted metal heel technology of the Westerner shoes should be incorporated into a pair of tea master-approved zori, and created the first seta. All of these stories seem a bit unlikely. They have the flavor of explanations made up long after the fact, and as far as I can tell, there's nothing like what you'd call evidence for any of them. But they're pretty good stories for all of that. I particularly like the one about the magistrates falling all over themselves as they try to pursue criminals. In my head, it plays out like it's an episode of Lupin the Third, where he is able to get away after the heist because he secretly stole the leather soles off of Inspector Zenigata's feet before the crime even started. But you know, I don't think that the seta sandals are the only reason these machines are called setters. But that will have to wait for another episode. You gotta leave them wanting something more. That's just good podcasting.
Joke's on you. They always want more, no matter what we do. Next time on episode 10.11, Paying the Toll, we research and discuss episode 11 of Victory Gundam and... no fighting in front of Haro! They're very sensitive! Bigger, badder battle bikes. Try saying that three times fast. Mean Girls. Uso the Nepo Baby. Won't somebody please think of the chickens? Shakti is losing it. Never talk to a yellow jacket. No witnesses!
No one's gonna get that. That's a special little joke just for us.
Do you know who my father is? No, but seriously, do you know him? And this is no James Gunn, pal, no James Gunn. Please listen to it.
Mobile Suit Breakdown is written, recorded, and produced by us, Tom and Nina, in scenic New York City, within the ancestral and unceded land of the Lenape people, and made possible by listeners like you. The opening track is Wasp by Misha Dioxin. The closing music is Long Way Home by Spinning Ratio. The recap music is Slow by Lloyd Rogers. You can find links to the sources for our research, the music used in the episode, additional information about the Lenape people, and more in the show notes on our website, GundamPodcast.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email hosts@GundamPodcast.com or look for links to our social media accounts on our website. And if you would like to support the show, please share us with your friends, leave a nice review wherever you listen to podcasts, or support us financially at GundamPodcast.com/Patreon. You can find links and more ways to help out at GundamPodcast.com/support. Thank you for listening.
I am ready. Unless a mouse shows up and throws off my groove.
Throw off the Empress's groove. Little squeaker.
We would not throw a mouse out the window. Even for throwing off our groove.
Unless the mouse had some sort of clever, like, glider contraption.
Tiny parachute.
Mouse parasailing through the air, landing on a mobile suit.
Mouse. Oh my god, a mouse mobile suit would be the size of a human and would be to help them fight humans.
I was just thinking, we're across the streams. It's not a mouse mobile suit. The mouse, like, paraglides over onto a human, scurries up of them to their head, grabs hold of the hair, and starts piloting them like a ratatouille.
So not just for fighting, but for the achievement of any and all mouse dreams.
Right.
That require being human-sized.
Well, you remember that one mecha show that was all about making candies, right?
That's true.
That's basically a ratatouille situation. I like referring to humans piloted by rodents as a ratatouille.
That's a ratatouille.
just like Mobile Suit Gundam. The original one was the Gundam. The original one was Pixar's Ratatouille.
Yep.
Now every piloted human, every rodent piloted human is a ratatouille.
Incredible. I love it.
Call me Pixar. I got ideas. I'm the author of several hit tweets. This is episode 10.10. I shouldn't be laughing as I say that.
No.
Finally, the third and most frequently repeated story says that a certain preeminent master of the tea ceremony, Sen no Rikyu, considered to be the most influential of all tea masters.
I was going to say, when you said a certain, I was like, oh, you mean, and then you said the name. I'm like, not a, like the guy. The guy.
Yes, the guy. So this story says that he was...
Sorry, you can cut my interjection.
Yeah, I'll start again.
Alarm is going off. As a longtime New York City resident, I firmly believe that car alarms should not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody hears a car alarm in the city and thinks, oh, someone's car is being stolen. Let's go look and make sure that it's not happening. Like, no. All anybody thinks is, oh my God, who has their car alarm enabled? We hate them.
Mm-hmm. The sheer balance of misery caused by a car alarm versus the actual marginal benefit they offer.
Well, and just the, like, it's so much more likely to go off because someone has to squeeze past your car to get to theirs, or is squeezing past to cross the street, or, you know, that's so much more likely than somebody trying to steal your car.
Yeah. Anyway, it stopped now.